Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 419th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of program and practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada. I'm also a professor at the University of Alberta. And today with us, we have Dr. Tina Koronic, who will be finishing off the guideline in opioid use disorder. But I'll just summarize a little bit of where we came from, what we got covered last time. We talked about how we design the guidelines and how we do them. We talked about how you can do some case finding for patients who are using opioid for analgesia, and you're wondering if they might have an opioid use disorder. Then in the last podcast, we talked about tapering, whether you should or not. And it's basically, if the patient desires an attempt at that, it's not unreasonable, but in almost all cases, it will not be effective, and we should not probably be advocating for tapers. We talked about the medications, the opioid agonist therapies of buprenorphine, methadone, and a little bit of naltrexone, but we focused on buprenorphine and methadone, and we found that they're both effective in improving treatment retention and abstinence. We talked about, how with some exploratory analysis, which isn't 100% solid, but still reasonable to confirm some of the observational data, that the opioid agonist therapy seems to reduce mortality. And lastly, we also did mention in the first podcast about how primary care is the right place or a good place to be managing patients with opioid use disorder. And so, Tina, I think we left off with kind of how do we improve retention and those kind of things with some of our practice tools, like managing contingencies, contracts, taking drugs to carry home, those kind of things. So why don't you take us through some of that evidence?
Yeah, for sure. So the biggest one is, after the medications, is the whole idea of psychosocial interventions. Is there evidence for counseling and things like that? And so we wanted to look into that. There was a Cochrane review that was done a few years ago that sort of concluded there wasn't evidence of benefit for most of those interventions, but we thought we'd go ahead and take another look. So when you look at the data around those, by far the most commonly studied intervention is something called contingency management. And contingency management is really sort of trying to motivate behaviors with, say, rewards and or punishments. And the review that had been done previously suggested that contingency management had no impact on outcomes like retention and treatment or what have you. However, when we reviewed the data, we saw there's a large number of randomized controlled trials around this, but you can sort of commonsensically divide them into two different types. There's sort of this positive contingency, so rewards for good behavior. So if you come in and your urine is clean, you might receive a voucher that you could buy some food with, or you might receive a lottery ticket or various different little prizes. So there's sort of positive contingencies. And when you look at the positive contingencies alone, they do result in a statistically significant improvement in retention and treatment. And so when we looked at that, the number needed to treat of about 11. So you do see a benefit. And however, when you look at the other type of contingency, which would be sort of punitive contingencies, primarily around medication. So historically in trials, if a patient was non-compliant, had opioids in their urine, they may have their medication dose reduced. They may lose privileges like take-home privileges or other sort of punitive interventions. And what we found in all the trials that involved those sort of medication-related contingencies, there was actually harm associated with that. So patients were less likely to be retained in treatment, more likely to leave treatment, a number needed to harm of about 12. So this sort of helped inform our recommendation around positive reinforcement and avoiding negative reinforcement. Because historically, it seems it was felt that if you sort of punitively or punished patients, that they would be more compliant or do the right thing. But it turns out they just leave the study, which is actually quite dangerous. So that led to one of our recommendations to avoid those negative sort of approaches unless you have concerns about safety of the patient or the community. So again, sort of reframing how we approach this condition. The other psychosocial interventions we looked at was counseling. Again, Cochrane had concluded that there was no benefit with counseling, but most of those had compared extended counseling to brief counseling. So when we looked at brief versus no counseling at all, we did see a benefit with a number needed to treat of about 8. So that retention and treatment, again, about 75% were retained with some minimal counseling compared to about 61% without any counseling at all. So there is some role for counseling, and some of our peer reviewers had this great insight that they said, you know, in primary care, that's the role you fill. That, and again, this is speculation, that may be why sometimes they do better, because they have that just basic, simple support and positive reinforcement. When we looked at extended versus brief counseling, it is true there's no difference. There's 3 randomized controlled trials that looked at that. One was in the New England Journal of Medicine, suggesting that, you know, 45 minutes didn't result in significant improvement over, say, a 15-20 minute intervention. And then we also looked at a few other sort of psychosocial interventions. We looked at technology-based interventions. We thought that was an interesting area to look at, especially for, again, communities that don't have any resources. If you don't have counselors, or you're a rural community and you don't have access to people, is there any evidence that technology-based interventions were helpful? And when you compare them, in the few trials that compared them to person interventions, there didn't seem to be much difference. So they may be an option in certain cases. And actually, patients spent a lot less time when they were in the computer-based interventions, but still had similar outcomes to the standard counseling. That one's a bit tricky because we don't have a specific technology-based intervention to recommend at this point, but assuming they were based on standard counseling techniques.
So there's a lot there, Tina, and I think it also, this speaks to some of the, especially the contingency management things, it speaks to our kind of reframing of how we think. And I was certainly trained to, if a patient is, you know, using other substances and all of that, that's the time to kind of intervene with kind of a punishment type approach. And mm-hmm. it turns out that that's wrong. We have to think about this like a chronic disease. And I like the analogies that have been given with, you know, a patient is, we're giving them, let's say a medicine for diabetes, and their A1C goes up, and we go, aha, you're not following what I say, so I'm going to stop your metformin now, or I'm going to stop your medicines. It's kind of, doesn't really make sense. It's more of an indication a lot of the time of inadequate treatment.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that analogy a lot, actually, because it is true, because sometimes our A1C goes up because we've been eating more sugar, or, I mean, not always, but you know what, we see that for sure, but we never punish patients for that. Never pull away medications. If anything, we try to optimize their treatment. So it's interesting.
It's a similar kind of thing. Yeah. So there was a lot of, like, the evidence review here, and people can check it out in the guideline itself. There's a lot of detailed evidence review and all of the outcomes that we looked at. And a lot of the times, as has been talked about in great detail, we just could not find evidence to support a lot of the outcomes or a lot of the interventions. So trying to find, like, for example, we tried to find things on cannabis use of, can it help with reducing the amount of opioids? Can it help in retention and treatment in that? And what did we find there, Tina?
Yeah, when we looked at cannabis, there was nothing. There was one small study looking at patients trying to sort of in withdrawal from opioid use, but there was nothing to guide the actual management of opioid use disorder. And so we ultimately recommended against the use of cannabis for opioid use disorder, partly because of the complete absence of evidence, and secondarily because of the increased risk of adverse events associated with the use of cannabis, which we've outlined in a previous guideline. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, this one kind of came back, I think, because some of our peer reviewers were had some concerns because initially the recommendation was a strong recommendation against the use of cannabis. And some peer reviewers said, I don't know about, you know, strong. How can you say that? So we went back to the committee and it was unanimous from our committee. This wasn't peer. It was the committee who said, we want a strong recommendation against because of absolute. They said if there was any other substance that had absolutely no evidence of benefit, why would we recommend it?
But,
Yeah. So it's very interesting in that. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. And Tina, what about some of the other things like urine drug screening and caries? What about those two things?
Yeah. So super good question. So when you're talking about when we did the 17 systematic reviews, 9 of the systematic reviews did not provide us with data that we felt we could really, you know, make strong recommendations. So in some of those areas, we made weak recommendations. So one of those is around urine drug testing. There's just really no, there's definitely no RCT evidence around the use of urine drug testing for outcomes. There is, you know, one observational study, but it shows that people who are more compliant with urine drug testing do better. But again, there's probably many confounders. So ultimately, our committee recommended that you could consider it, but that it shouldn't be a mandatory piece. And part of these recommendations come from that idea of removing the barriers that are already present in primary care to provide this type of medication. Because a lot of docs express concerns, you know, I have to do urine tests. I don't even, and this came up in our clinic. I mean, the interpretation, we tried to get someone, anyone, to give us a one pager on how to interpret urines. And I've asked across the country, if anyone can provide me with one, that'd be great. Even in our province, I asked someone in the lab services and they said, well, no, we couldn't do that. Then physicians wouldn't have enough information.
Oh,
and I just thought that's insane that it's that difficult. And if it's that difficult, you know, what are we asking primary care docs to do? And there's no evidence that actually clearly states that improves outcomes. So we think it's a useful tool to begin a discussion with your patient and understand what they're on. But to put specific requirements on how often or when it should be done, we didn't think that's just putting up barriers to being able to provide patients with the care they need. And interestingly, in Alberta, we met with our provincial college and they agreed with us. And so the provincial standards don't have any specific regulations around urine drug testing, which is great.
And what about caries, Tina? What about taking the drugs home with you and that kind of thing? Because I know there's been lots of debate about that.
Yeah. And again, this is another one. Again, when there's in the absence of evidence, there's strong opinions on both sides. There's some people who think everyone should have caries all the time. And then there's another group of people who say, oh, that's really dangerous. But when we look at the evidence, there's very limited data, but the data we did see that looked at sort of extending doses, say for, you know, 2 to 3, 4, 7 days versus daily, there was no difference in outcomes. And again, that idea of reducing barriers, especially for patients in rural communities, patients who are stable, who actually need to work, all of these groups, we made the recommendation that you could consider take-home doses as an option when need and stability indicates. So that idea, if you have a stable patient who, you know, has other things they need to do during the day, then go to the pharmacy, then that's an option for them for sure.
And James, you've always made the pharmacy a fun place to be.
I mean, really, you know, is there anything more fun than, you know, waiting in line to get a prescription? I don't think so.
It's so fun. So, right. And if you love the pharmacy, great. Then you should go every day.
And then what are some of the few last things, Tina? I would say maybe... did we mention contracts?
That was the other thing I was just going to say. Yes. So the idea of, and now, you know, maybe we, well, first of all, what's the evidence around contracts? Because that's been a standard for a long time. There's no evidence actually. And there's a great Cochrane review that says there's absolutely no evidence, but we do it because it seems like the right thing to do. If you look at them though, two issues. One, most contracts, include negative contingencies. So they include, if you don't comply, you know, I'm going to reduce your dose or take away your privileges or drop you as a patient. And so some of our peer reviewers, again, made a great point. It's really there just to protect the primary care doc so they can pull the plug at any time.
Right.
And so that idea first, that those punitive measures are not helpful and you're probably losing patients to treatment because of it. And there's no evidence overall that they improve outcomes. So again, we made the recommendation you could consider a treatment agreement. So not that I... one who's sensitive about terminology, but in this case, it's more of an agreement, just outlining expectations. This is how we're going to move forward. Here's the medication I'm going to give you. And that's a consideration just so everyone knows what's happening, but avoiding the negative and sort of punitive interventions and saying it should be considered. It may, you know, if the patient presents on the first day and they're in withdrawal and they just need buprenorphine, naloxone, maybe that's not the time to be running through it. But at some point to consider it as part of your overall plan, but not to let it, again, be a barrier to initiating treatment in patients who need it.
Awesome. And I think the last piece that we need to talk about before we just talk about some nuances of the guideline is that we tried to find things on comorbidities, like what about patients who suffer from opioid use disorder, but also complain about insomnia or anxiety, or are still continuing to suffer or have their chronic pain issue, but recently got, let's say, a fracture or dislocated shoulder. How do we manage these? And I think the bottom line, Tina, was there's virtually no evidence, and we should just continue to manage these patients as we would manage any other patients with these conditions.
Yeah. Yeah. This is an area that I would love to see well-done trials on to guide us in this area. But there is none, really. There's very little evidence to guide us. So this is where we would lean on colleagues who have experience in the management of this. And I agree. One of our, again, a peer reviewer made this really insightful comment that these people shouldn't be defined by this disease. They should be treated with the same excellent care everyone else is receiving.
Right.
That's great, actually.
Yeah, and we have lots of evidence of those sorts of things regardless.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, and we just have to be cognizant that they have a substance use disorder. So jumping for insomnia, jumping right away to something like a Zopiclone or a benzo is not the best choice. So what are the other options for insomnia, like sleep restriction therapy and all of those other things before we get there, and maybe other medications with less substance use potential. So I think as clinicians, it's somewhat freeing to recognize that there's an absence of evidence, and we just need to use our clinical judgment, common sense, and those kind of core things.
And I think basically that's what we've been saying for about 419 podcasts.
Yeah, except for statins. We have evidence there. So stop doing statin trials.
Exactly.
Okay, let's talk, Tina, just a tiny bit about I think one of the key things that this guideline took a step from our previous guidelines. We had reasonable graphics before on that, but I would say this time we really, you under your stewardship of the peer team.
Right. Yes.
We went to a whole different level of prettifying, you know, making these things pretty and beautiful that under me was doomed to failure.
So what I've seen is I passed it off to someone with more.
I don't. I wasn't going to mention that. But
yeah. That's fair.
But the figure one, the opioid use disorder primary care pathway, I think is really well done. And it contains the Palm Eye tool. It also contains a flow where you can go to buprenorphine, naloxone, and some people, I know we don't like to use trade names, but that can be Suboxone. And it talks about how to do that a little bit. And it also talks about retention and treatment and gives a small graphic showing that how far along a pathway. So at 64% versus 39. And I really think that it just got so condensed and tight with so little content. It's, with not an overwhelming amount of content, it's just really well done. And then asked about counseling therapy and gives some really good guidance there.
And I think, one of the key features is that, we always call these guidelines simplified, and we don't do that because they have to be simplified. It's just that we can make them simplified. And I think it's really useful if we can make a useful synopsis of the best available evidence so that you guys can use it. It really, really helps healthcare providers, do shared decision making and just think about the whole thought process.
Absolutely. That's one of our goals in all of our guidelines is, it's to be evidence-based, it's to be primary care, but one of the key elements there is simplified as well. Can we make this simpler and easier to use in primary care? And this continues that theme. Figure two is a really excellent induction flow sheet because many of us are not really strong or comfortable with prescribing buprenorphine naloxone. And so This gives you the scoring system that you use, how to apply it. There's a lot of great content in here, Tina, which I know is not a surprise to you, having dedicated a year of your life to this. But it is exceptionally well done. And I encourage people who haven't had a chance to look at the guideline to spend a little bit of time either online, going to Canadian Family Physician, or pulling it out from the journal. And the journal did, the National College supported a one-page handout that you can keep on your wall and just pull it down for quick guidance. So that's really helpful.
Yeah, I love that. Basically, the guideline can be summarized in that sort of one pager. There's some key things in it, but the key points. So page one is really the evidence piece. Page two is more the practical piece, which we had some fabulous input from our committee members who really helped us along this. And so this induction, there's probably, 100 different ways you could start buprenorphine with different doses. But this was a nice, simple approach that we thought, clinicians who are new, because this is another thing. A lot of people aren't even sure how to start these medications. Gives them a template to start anyways.
Yeah. No, it's another great piece of work where Peer has lost a year of its life.
Maybe 5 years of our life.
Yeah, that's true enough. There's a lingering effect here. But I think that wraps it up, James.
So kudos to the Peer group, really, for all the work that they've done to put this entire thing together, because it's an awful lot of work. And they've really done a great job of putting it all together. So definitely kudos for them. So is there anything else?
I think we're good. No concerns from my end. I think we've covered a lot of good ground here and help people understand what was involved and what we found in our 17 systematic reviews, boiled down to just a few podcasts.
Yeah. No, great.
So thanks as always for listening.